Good morning, everyone. We welcome you to our Sunday morning roundtable discussion with our subject of matter. We are recording today from the Plainfield Christian Science Church in Plainfield, New Jersey, the United States of America, and we are an independent church. We welcome you all, and we'll start with our morning prayer.
Reading from page 204 of the Blue Book, Divinity Course and General Collectania, and starts with, "Oh, may you feel the touch of the spiritual idea that is the light in your path. Do not be anxious, knock and find and stand in the consciousness of truth. Do not look to matter to tell you your success, but look up, for your harvest is right at hand. You know the Father's love. Trust it. Then when you hear a whisper, now you are a sinner, and so is your punishment. This suffering is the consequence. Put it out. Put it out. Animal magnetism says you are a sinner when you know you are not going deliberately to work to sin. Then empty your thought of fear and say, I look to God, my Father, to see what I am. He alone shall tell me of myself." Mary Baker Eddy.
It's wonderful, very important. Air is always trying to tell us things. God alone tells us who we are. Thank you. Okay, our watching point, Karen.
Watch number 350. Watch lest when you feel that you are attaining a victory over matter or mortal mind, and it seems to close in on you darker than ever, you become discouraged. Perhaps you are experiencing a divine testing or strengthening. When a plant pokes its little head above ground, a wise gardener may put a shovelful of earth upon it. He does this because its roots are not yet strong enough. He takes this method of compelling it to grow sturdier roots. He may repeat his performance several times until the plant proves that it has roots that are strong and deep enough, so that it can endure whatever storm comes along. The plant might become discouraged if it did not understand the purpose behind what was happening. God is the wise gardener who knows our every need and meets that need even when we cannot see what the need is.
Thank you. Okay, comments on that?
Well, the first thing that came to me this morning when I came down here was I thought of Jesus's temptation. As soon as he was baptized and went into the desert for 40 days to commune with God, the first temptation is that he needs matter to feed his hunger. And so I thought to myself, okay, he reverted to what? The word of God. He said, it is written. All three times he reverted to the Old Testament. And the first one was, it is written. God, man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceedeth out of the mouth of God. So I looked up some passages on what would be needed. And we're tempted to think that we're discouraged or we're not getting anywhere. And five short little biblical passages came up that I thought were so, you know, just pick one of them. But 2 Corinthians, my grace is sufficient for thee. Psalm 73, my flesh and my heart faileth, but God is the strength of my heart and my portion forever. Nehemiah 8. The joy of the Lord is your strength. Psalms 46, God is in the midst of her. She shall not be moved. God help her. God shall help her, and that right early. And then Philippians 4, I can do all things through Christ, which strengtheneth me. So that's where we go. We go to the Word of God and to strengthen us. And that's what Jesus did, and he's our master. So
thank you. That'll make a good article. It's very good. It's exactly right. It is written. And it struck me too many years ago. We always went to the Bible to get, and that's why we study. You study and study, and then something comes and you just fall to pieces. No. Mm-hmm. What does the Bible say? What does God say about this? What does science and health say about it? And then combat it with that and keep combating it until it's beaten down to nothing. Only God can tell you who you are and what you are. And mm-hmm. all these discouraging thoughts are just not to be listened to. If you do, then you'll suffer until you stop.
Mm-hmm. If it comes to us, say sometimes you feel so elevated and with God, and then something comes, and it can be so discouraging. It can make you go back to start again with the error, as if it's true. And this constancy of knowing that no error is never, never, never true, and we are never, never, never separated from him, it's so reassuring. It really keeps you always going higher and higher and higher. And it's good that we have our colleagues to help us. Maybe somebody will say something in the testimony meeting that keeps you going with the truth, that no matter what is being said, no matter what error is screaming, it has no power. It has no power. I have found that very, very helpful. Yeah.
Thank you.
Well, that's so good. Thank you, Florence, because we need to remember, Earth is a schoolhouse for us. Mm-hmm. And when we, when we start learning the truth, we're going to have tests. It's like being in school. You sit through classes and you learn stuff. And it may seem really, really nice and, but then you have to pass a test. And not everybody enjoys taking tests.
And if you goof off, you got to stay back.
Right.
And until you get it. If you've been goofing off, you've got to learn.
But we need to learn to take tests. We need to learn to accept the tests and look forward to the tests even. Because that's how we grow and grow closer to God. So in life, as we learn, and it's been my observation that the people who are most useful to God will have the most severe tests. People who are not useful to God might appear to be going along just kind of smoothly and not having many problems and that sort of thing, but they're not growing spiritually. So they're not to be envied.
As Mrs. A said, trials are proofs of God's care.
Yeah, and when we learn to look forward to the trials.
Go ahead, Gary. Go ahead.
When we learn to look forward to the trials, then we're really in a good place.
Yeah, because then error can't get to you, it's trying to intimidate you, if it could. Of course, we know error is not really even real, but so yeah, if you look forward to it and say, okay, and what good are you if you can only, when things are going well, then maybe you're okay, but as soon as some little thing comes up, then you fall to pieces. That just shows you don't know the science yet. And you'll keep having those experiences until you get where you know the science and you can stand unmoved. Mrs. Eddy says that, unmoved by the whatever it is that's confronting you.
And the other thing Florence said that's so important is that is the purpose of a church. That is the real purpose of a church, is to look out for one another. And to support one another when things get really tough. And to keep directing one another in the right direction. And that is the sole purpose of church. And Mrs. Evans used to remind us many, many times, you know, one stick you can break, but a bundle of sticks you can't break. And if we are all part of a really good bundle, we're not going to break.
Elizabeth? Are you trying to say something?
I was just thinking how the word discouragement is pretty much the opposite of gratitude. And when we claim our God-given birthright to gratitude, it's not something that we choose or don't choose. It's something that is part of us, and when we claim that and just start being grateful, anything that comes along, any kind of grumbling, any kind of pity can be extinguished with gratitude, even if it's just gratitude for the simplest things, like has been said here before, of just opening your eyes in the morning. You know, and everything. I mean, there's so much to be grateful for, and sometimes you have to start small, but there are big things too.
Thank you. That's absolutely.
One of them is being here right now.
Well, that's true. I mean, you know, that in itself, all this stuff we pour out every day, it's all free. And are you grateful for it? I mean, if you were really grateful for it, you'd have no reason to be discouraged. That's true.
And it also gets, there's something called moral courage. The courage to stand up for what you know is right, in spite of any and all opposition. The word discourage is the opposite of courage.
Yes.
If you're easily discouraged, ask yourself, do I really have a lot of moral courage, or am I missing something? In the courage department.
Thank you. Yeah. Ability to stand up against all our odds. And remember, when things are going well, not to just cruise along. That's the time you have to work all the more. Because you cruise along and then pretty soon, poof. So, no, work all the more. Then you eliminate. It's either science or suffering. If you're working during the, shall we call the more pleasant days, then you don't have to come to the suffering. But many people just go to sleep then and let down. Never let down.
There is always waiting for you to let down.
It is. Yes. Craig, did you want to say something?
Mm-hmm.
No. Okay.
Appreciate it.
I think one more thing I read on in page 205 too. As I said, he's saying that in treating a claim, never become discouraged if it reappears.
Mm-hmm.
But go to work and keep on treating it each time, and each time it will appear in a milder form. Finally, it will disappear forever. So that background of knowing that God has this a promise that I will be with you, whether in the water or in the fire. So the constancy of knowing God is with me, no matter what is happening, God is right here with me. You go
Thank
forward
you.
And know that it's milder and milder until it will disappear.
Yes, thank you. Because that's often the discouragement. Oh, here it is again, or whatever. And we've been also taught it's not the same error. It's different. It's not the same thing. We have new lessons to learn. The falling leaves, we
not,
sweep
not,
up.
It's not the same batch of leaves.
Not
it's
the
new
yeah.
leaves.
New leaves, we got to sweep
gotta
up.
Be reckoned.
Just keep going. Persistence wins the prize, always. Thank you. All of those were wonderful. Florence wanted to talk about an article, The Practice of Christian Science by Bicknell Young, which is extremely important, a good article. He has written wonderful things, oneness, God is individual consciousness. All of you should be aware of them, of these articles, and work with them as much as you can. So this one is as well is very important. So Florence, mm-hmm. want to speak
well,
to
this
that?
Is the one, it's on the website. You know, we have two. One of them is Bicknell Young in the collected writings. Is the first one, the practice of Christian science practice. And then there's this shorter one, a brief one, that says the practice of Christian science. And he goes through the whole thing about treatment and how you know one has to get with God, be silent, listen, and listen for the click, he says, the click or the release of you know, feeling responsible. I've got to do this. It's because when God is present, then we know error cannot be present as well. So it's all about, you know, getting quiet, feeling the presence of God. It's always feeling the presence of God, because when the Christ is here now, all errors will be dissolved. You will feel a certain way. You will feel the release from your responsibility. Is God is on the field, right? When God is on the field, nothing else, no opposites can be there. And so I think it's a very good article. The practice, again, I say it's called the practice of Christian science. You may have a recording as well, I think, on the
website.
Yes,
we do.
Yeah. The long one doesn't, but this shorter one has a recording as well. So I think it's one of the things that we should be all familiar with. It ends with just right identification and reinterpretation. Because if we are knowing who we are all the time, we know that, you know, these errors are not part of us. But sometimes I think we have a lot of truths that we've memorized, and we say it, and we think that these truths themselves have the power. That's not so. It's the presence of God that has that power, and one can get to it through, you know, practicing what he has illustrated here. He talks about the, you know, seeing error for what it is. It's not true. It's not those two trains coming together. It's not as if the horizon, the sky meets the mountain and all of that. It's very practical, very simple. I think it's very clear to me. That's basically it. Mm-hmm.
Sometimes people will ask, you know, well, how do you give a treatment? Well, this tells you, and it's not this idea that most people have. You go to a practitioner, the practitioner thinks these thoughts about the patient, but it's the practitioner knowing his oneness, and it's this article starts off, the first part of our practice is going to be waking up in the morning in the conscious realization of our oneness with God.
Yes.
So, I and my Father are one, the Father that dwelleth in me, he doeth the works, and the Father hath not left me alone. So in that knowing your oneness, and he says too, you don't bring the patient in and the disease in, and you think about all this, it's knowing God and that still quiet spot where you're just at one with the Father. And when you really feel that, then anyone in your thought is greatly healed and benefited by it. So it's very.
Also talks about, except the Lord build a house, they labor in vain that build it. So it makes sense. It does make sense that it's God you go to. It's God you want, you know, the feeling of, the presence of. And that dissolves the lie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he says, do not try to reform the outer picture. Yes. With your inner God-given spiritual sense, look at the heart and see the Christ. Mm-hmm. You will find the Christ. You will find the most wonderful healing force there is in the world. Look not at drunkenness, thievery, violence, disease, etc., but through it. Do not look with the eyes. Close the eyes physically, or at least turn away. Then let your feeling guide you. Get a feeling of Christ sitting right there in the center of individual being. So
The lie may be screaming, but God, when God is, when you feel that sense of the presence of God, it can't be there.
Thank you, Florence. So, yeah, very, very important article. I feel pretty much all of Bicknell Young's articles are very important. He had a great, clear understanding of the science and explains it very clearly. If you find him a little difficult, which I did at first, you know, then Martha Wilcox, Carpenter, Peter V. Ross, all of them are Kratzer. So you choose the one that speaks to you.
Okay, I think everybody has their own path through the early worker.
Yeah, that's very true. All right, Nancy, your article that you sent, please.
Yes, this is from Froese Works in the chapter Unity of Good. Mrs. Eddy writes, "There is no matter. If God is spirit and God is all, surely there can be no matter. For the divine all must be spirit. The tendency of Christianity is to spiritualize thought and action. The demonstrations of Jesus annulled the claims of matter and overruled laws material as emphatically as they annihilated sin. According to Christian Science, the first idolatrous claim of sin is that matter exists. The second, that matter is substance. The third, that matter has intelligence. And the fourth, that matter, being so endowed, produces life and death. Hence, my conscientious position in the denial of matter rests on the fact that matter usurps the authority of God, Spirit, and the nature and character of matter, the antipode of Spirit, include all that denies and defies Spirit in quantity or quality." And it's excellent. It goes on. I hope everybody reads it. It's very, very good.
It is. I mean, she is getting into the scientific statement of being. And I love that. The first idolatrous claim is that matter exists. Mm-hmm. And then that it has substance. And then that it has intelligence. And then that it has life. It's very powerful. And she did call Unity of Good her masterpiece. And yes, so it is. And this, Ingrid, you evolve into all of this. It doesn't mean that that we go walking on water necessarily or don't stop eating. And Jesus Christ and Mrs. Eddy were our examples. And they did. Eventually, these things fall away as your thought is spiritualized, as you embrace these truths. And you will find this true. But don't worry. You know, I think often of that beautiful article Mrs. Eddy wrote just for today that Karen recorded. But she said, you know, it's with a sweet sense of God's nearness. Just for today, I will know that yesterday is gone and left no bitterness. Today is big with blessings. And tomorrow belongs to God. Absolutely. Stop fussing about tomorrow. The Lord's Prayer, give us today our daily bread. We're always fussing about tomorrow or what we think we should be or how we have to act. Just for today, do these simple things. Yesterday's gone, no bitterness. Today is big with blessings. And tomorrow belongs to God. I can do that. I can do that just for today.
Mm-hmm. Mrs. A says in miscellaneous writings that never ask for tomorrow. It is enough that divine love is an ever-present help. And if you wait, never doubting, you will have all you need every moment.
Thank you. Yes. Yeah, we have enough to deal with today. Stay in today. Stay in the present.
No.
Of it is.
Yes, and I know this
Ingrid,
has been
just
on cover.
Ingrid Craig is talking. Just
the
a minute.
Of it, you miss so much happiness and joy if you try to speed through to what's going on next. It's enjoying with the present. There's so much love and harmony and peace and health right now to share it and to experience. And people, their minds are racing, they kind of blow it. You know, God saying, I love you. Enjoy yourself.
So true. Thank you.
And now, Chardell, what did you send us?
Oh, this is in Science and Health, at number 3, 181. Where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. And that's right from Matthew and Luke. And then I looked it up, and Mrs. Hogue, Ella W. Hogue, wrote Heavenly Treasures. I'll just read a little bit of it, and you can stop me if I read too much. Jesus makes it very plain in his Sermon on the Mount that the treasures in heaven are the only ones that can be relied upon. And then he goes on to say, where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. And then in the Bible, it always tells us and told us of heavenly riches and has urged the need of looking to God for them. It has also shown that these riches can only be obtained as men give up that which did not come from God, and that in Christian Science comes with its God-given explanation of the scriptures proclaiming the possibility of reversing all the elusive, unsatisfactory effort. It opens the way for men to turn squarely around and show them how to start in exactly the opposite direction toward the attaining of all that is everlasting.
And okay, then, the last paragraph.
The last one, yes. That's Mrs. Eddy. Let me get there. Mrs. Eddy tells us in Science and Health, with Key to the Scriptures, page 5, God pours the riches of his love into the understanding and affections, giving us strength according to our day. Mm-hmm. And what are the riches of his love? Listen to Mrs. Eddy's enumeration of some of them in Science and Health, page 248. Unselfishness, goodness, mercy, justice, health, holiness, love. And she goes on to say that if these reign within us, sin, disease, and death will diminish until they finally disappear. Shall I stop there?
No.
Now here, all right, here then is the way to seek heavenly treasures and the way to find them manifested here and now. From this, it follows that we are not to look to matter for anything, not to seek matter, not to think about matter at all. Instead, we must desire only God-like qualities. We must cling to them, dwell with them, let them reign in us, and thus prove that they alone are real and desirable. In the degree that we do this, we are forsaking worldliness and laying up treasures in heaven.
That is a wonderful explanation of this. And that statement in Science and Health is one we, as you know, we were given to teach our children as a nighttime prayer. That idea, let unselfishness, goodness, mercy, justice, health, holiness, love, the kingdom of heaven reign within us, and sin, disease, and death will diminish until they finally disappear. It's very powerful, but this is the heavenly treasures, the treasures that no one can take from you, that moth and rust cannot corrupt, and everyone can have them, right? There's no one that can't have these treasures. You just have to express them.
Yeah, they're not in short supply.
They're not in short supply. There's an abundance of it, and we must desire these qualities, cling to them, dwell with them, let them reign in us, and thus prove that they alone are real and desirable. And this is seeking the kingdom of heaven, the kingdom of God first, and having all these other things added unto you. Hugely important here. I love this explanation of this statement in Science and Health. So, and you know, Mrs. Eddy has said, the recuperative action of the system, when mentally sustained by truth, goes on naturally. And so when you are focusing on this truth of all these qualities that you possess as a child of God, if you express them, your body is going to heal naturally. It will. The recuperative action of the system goes on naturally when mentally sustained by truth. It will go on naturally as you do this. On the other hand, if you're rah, 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 well, that's not so good for yourself, for your body, for your well-being. And you'll experience something else until you stop it in belief. So, and this goes along with what we've talked about in past roundtables about the virtue medicine. All these qualities, as you express them, they bring healing to your body, to your soul, your mind, peace. So check yourself. As we talked about last week, Karen was saying every hour she checks if she has her oneness with the Father. Are you one with God, or are you upset about something, poofing around with something? Lawrence, did you want to speak to this?
Oh, are you feeling separated from him? That's the whole point.
Yes. And you will be if you're not expressing these qualities.
Mm-hmm.
Expressing your oneness. And then this was a beautiful article Carrie sent me last week, but it's about also the wealth is scientifically understood by H.L. Gualter. But it says, the true sense of wealth binds us closely with God. Since in order to have an abundant supply, which will never fail us, we have to turn to the infinite. Infinite good is the ever-flowing source from which all good must come. And if we can only realize wealth in the going out of good through us to others, our measure of wealth lies in our ability to give. But on the other hand, a material sense of riches, on the other hand, would tend to separate us from God and our fellow man through cares, worldliness, pride, fear, and limitation, producing spiritual barrenness. You might have a lot materially, but spiritually you are barren. The psalmist says, they that trust in their wealth and boast themselves in the multitude of their riches, none of them can by any means redeem his brother, nor give to God a ransom for him, that he should still live forever and not see corruption. Happiness can only dwell in the understanding of wealth as a manifestation of the abundance of divine love, and in the consciousness of reflecting love, thereby calling forth the response of love. But I love that thought too. When you get your abundance from God, you're gonna be happy, peaceful, at one with your fellow man, at one certainly with God. When you're out beating the world and trying to get more money and keep up with the Joneses, you're gonna separate yourself from God, from your fellow man, and probably have a pretty miserable life, even though you might have a lot of things. Is that not true?
Very true.
It is true. And you may covet your neighbor.
You may covet your neighbor. It's an endless, endless thing.
You definitely will covet.
Yeah.
For sure. Because if you're looking for substance in material things, if you're looking for wealth in material things, you're never going to find it. And you're going to be miserable.
Yeah. Yeah, when you realize. It's so awesome to realize that your abundance is in the qualities that mm-hmm. are inherently ours of contentment and fullness and purpose. And when we have those qualities, then we suddenly realize that's our abundance. And that's about looking away from or starting with God, and then everything else is added to you. So you have everything that you need, but the true stuff is just like you've been saying. where moth and rust don't corrupt. And it's just so wonderful.
Yeah. It is so wonderful. And it, I'm quoting some articles that Carrie sent, but one is, the sense of peace and harmony is found in the realization of God's presence and power. That is peace and harmony.
And wealth.
And wealth. That you must have. I don't care. You can have all this stuff, but if you don't know the presence and power of God, how can you be happy? I don't think you can be.
Well, we see it in all these people who buy $56 million home and this home and that home and still not satisfied. And quite frankly, some are afraid of losing still.
They're afraid of all of that. Exactly. They're very afraid.
Mm-hmm. Gary sent me another. I can't find it right now, but it was a list of all the things that happen if you think you find your wealth in matter. It's terrible. And that's one of them. You're worried other people are going to take it from you. You can't. You want more and more and more. You're never satisfied. It's a whole list. I mean, she said, why would anyone want that? And people that have these super big homes. And I mean, how big does your house have to be? Especially when other people are suffering and might benefit from your charity.
Exactly.
So, and in another article, it talks about Christianity is not a philosophy. It is a revelation creating enthusiasm. Enthusiasm for God. Enthusiasm for humanity. Enthusiasm for life. Directly, it loses enthusiasm, it becomes a philosophy. It ceases to be a religion. No man can be truly happy who is not Christian, and no man can rightly call himself a Christian who is not happy. Now think about that. And one of the ways you can tell Christians, a real Christian, is they look so darn happy. And they do. Don't their faces mm-hmm. just beam, right?
Yes. Right.
Mm-hmm. And it's not it's a true happiness, a true joy in God.
So can I change something?
Just a minute. Craig is speaking.
Oh, I'm sorry. I keep seeing a loving face, like an outpouring face, kindness.
Yes. Yes. Mm-hmm. It's a loving, unselfish, happy look. And why? Because they know their Redeemer lives.
That's right.
And nothing can take it away. Not all the troubles of the world. Your joy, no man takes from you. Okay, Ingrid.
And you had brought some really good quotes about materiality, and it brought to me this great one that says in Science and Health, the first idolatry was physicality, and that's one that, you know, we need so much about all related to all we're talking about. What a great quote. I'm very grateful for that.
Yes. Yes. Now, and you sent an article too. Would you like to say anything about that? The 10th commandment on satisfaction.
Oh, me? Karen?
Oh, yes, you, Karen, right? It was you?
Yes,
was
me. That was me.
That was Karen.
Yeah. There's a little book by Irma Stewart called The Ten Commandments. She also did one on Sermon on the Mount. But the 10th commandment, I love what she said about 10th commandment. It's everything that we've been talking about here. And I've also learned that the law of Moses was lifted to a more spiritual sense by the gospel. And so she calls the 10th commandment satisfaction, which is what handles covetousness. So of course the commandment says, thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's house, thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wife, nor his manservant, nor his maidservant, nor his ox, nor his ass, nor anything that is thy neighbor. And she says, satisfaction knows no privation, no seeking, no longing, wishing, wanting, striving, and no acquiring. The greed for gain is an external, incomplete sense of existence.
neighbor being an aspect of one's own being and not an externality, that which appears as thy neighbor's is not an external private possession, but a symbol of all-inclusive sufficiency. Excuse me. Man's life consists not in an abundant sense of externalities, but his satisfaction itself. It is that Pentecostal impersonal presence which is not approaching spirituality nor striving for anything. It is proceeding from and as its own divine innate nature. The recognition of this is divine self-sufficiency. It appears with the willingness to surrender unreservedly all human, material, personal anticipations. It casts out fear and is humanly evidenced as unity, brotherhood, abundance. This broadening viewpoint, recognizing the universal character of experience, enhances one's beneficent ability, and love is found asserting itself as the full, unassailable satisfaction of existence. That which one knows as the very essence of his being, that which rightly makes one released, joyous, sure, is the law of loving care to whatever one may humanly appear to be. The suggestion that that which makes life safe or interesting is in externalities is the serpent of usurpation. Joy and satisfaction are always within oneself. They have nothing to do with doing in the general accepted sense of that word. They relate directly to how we think about ourselves and about that which we call our universe. In the way we know, accept, reject, understand, in other words, in our mental attitude. Because love is forever evidencing itself as the all and only presence, to feel this is progressive unfoldment. It is the wellspring of life flowing forth from within, the acme of perfection, the substance and satisfaction of love. And then she has a beautiful poem following that.
Thank you. This commandment in this week's lesson is a very important one because it's a lot of unhappiness and trouble stems from this coveting what others have. And I've given this story before, but it made such a big impression on me as a child in Sunday school here. And I wasn't in Mrs. Evans' class, but her class was near me and I was leaning over to listen. She was talking about this commandment and telling the children if you saw someone making X's and you wanted those X's, what would you do? And no one had the answer and I didn't either. I thought, well, what would you do? You grab the X's, take it from the other person. And she just simply said, no, you would make your own. You make your own. Stop coveting what others have. What in the heck are you doing with your life? Make your own joy, make your own happiness, make your home as beautiful as it possibly can, even if it's just a little tiny apartment. Do what you can with the cards you've been dealt with, and you will get more cards. But if you grumble and just covet what someone else has, you're not going to get anywhere. That you're disobeying a commandment, my friends, not a suggestion, a commandment. And there's a reason for it, because when you do it, you are a miserable mortal. When you disobey any of these commandments, you're a miserable mortal. That's why they're commandments, not suggestions.
Yeah, now, it goes along with stealing and murder.
Murder, yeah. Nations fighting, yeah. Wanting what the other one has.
And it may be the third most important commandment, because all the other commandments are things you should or should not do, right? This is the only commandment that tells you how you should think. And if you obey this commandment, you will not be tempted to violate any of the other commandments.
Thank you. In a really good article, again, Carrie sent, Thou Shalt Not Covet. It brings out, as Christian Scientists, we perhaps think we are now immune from covetousness because we see fully setting our hearts on material objects certainly in those of our neighbors, we've come to see in a degree that true substance is spiritual and that material objects such as money, clothes, and so on cannot bring enduring happiness. Hopefully everyone sees that or is getting to see that. But then she says, but what of our neighbor's spiritual attainments? Do we not covet them? When we see someone's enlarged capacity, his freer step, his more joyful look, do we not think, why cannot I attain these? Here the error is a little more subtle, and unconsciously perhaps we long for the good which our neighbor has attained. The possible struggle through which he went, the evil which he forsook in acquiring his spiritual good, we lose sight of and vainly wish that his good might become ours. How impossible such a desire. Now, this is what we talked about yesterday with Simony. He wanted to buy what he couldn't have, what he hadn't earned. The reward he has received, he has earned. We may be sure he did not get it by chance or by special favor, for God is no respecter of persons. Even though our neighbor were willing to transfer his reward to us, he could not do so. Good is not transferable from one person to another. The good which an individual can gain comes to him from God. He gets it moreover not as a special gift from the Father of Lights, but as the effect of righteous living. Good has always existed. It lies at hand. It is ever present. But it comes to one's experience only as one allows evil belief to be dispensed with. Please remember this, because I hear it from Christian Scientists. Or, you know, I'm working so hard. He's not even a Christian Scientist. He has all this and I don't. Please, 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 thou shalt not covet. Or whatever else comes to you. Or they had a better life and that's why I'm so miserable. You take what you have and you make it blossom. And you can. Why? Because you've got God, right? What more do you need?
You don't know what they went through to get there.
Yes.
Blood, sweat, and tears.
You do not. You make very bad judgments judging others. Mm-hmm. Or you see someone who thinks, I saw it recently. Somebody, I thought they were having a wonderful life, a great marriage. Whoops. They're not. They might be getting a divorce. You don't know. So don't judge. Stop it. Follow the Sermon on the Mount, please. That's why to listen to it every day. You don't judge. You don't covet. Just mind your own P's and Q's, and you'll do just fine.
It's a little hard.
How to use the talents you were given, just like in the parable. The only person in the parable that didn't grow was the one that buried his talent. The others, regardless of how many they were given, improved them.
Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yes, and Little Heartsease, that story that's in our new Liberator, which will be out soon. Gary will end with a short article again from Kerry.
An excerpt from an article entitled Step by Step by Mabel Reed. She writes, in Psalms, we read, the steps of a good man are ordered by the Lord. The importance of the word steps in this sentence is corroborated by the fact that all through the Bible, each achievement of the prophets and of the disciples is shown to have been accomplished by steps. In the vision of Jacob, the angels of God were seen ascending and descending a ladder composed of steps, indicating that even the angels, God's thoughts, do not precipitate themselves upon us, nor do we reach them by spontaneous soaring, but by being obedient and taking the steps which eventually bring us to spiritual heights. In the words of our hymn, step by step since time began, we see the steady gain of man, end quote. It lies with each one of us to move forward, overcoming as we go all obstacles of discouragement, doubt, fear, or whatever would impede, and running with patience the race that is set before us. It is only from the vantage point of a step taken that we can see to take the next step. And each advancing step is surely ordered by the Lord. End quote.
Yeah. Thank you all so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.